Hyundai's hot new Tucson, pollution in Paris, and we drive the Volt.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Dodge. And by Henkel, excellence is our passion.
This is Autoline After Hours with Gary Vasilash, episode 305 for October 9th, 2015. The Tucson Also Rises.
Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Good afternoon, everyone. As you can see, I'm not John. John is embedded with some automotive executives right now, and so I'll be hosting the show, and we're going to have a great time this afternoon, because joining me is Richard Truitt of Automotive News. How are you doing, Richard?
Doing great. Thanks, Gary.
Good. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And Henry Payne of the Detroit News.
Gary, good to be with you.
Good to be with you. So I saw you two guys. We were both last week in Northern California driving the Volt, so we will talk about that a little later on. So
let's do a show from Northern California in, say, January. What do you think?
That would be a very good idea. I'm completely in favor of doing that. But so more importantly, we have our guest, our very special guest here this afternoon, Mike O'Brien, who is the Vice President of Corporate and Product Planning for Hyundai Motor America. And I've got to say to you right off the top, happy National Hydrogen and Fuel Cell Day.
Excellent.
So apparently this day was established October 8th because it relates, the numbers relate to the weight of hydrogen, right?
I heard so, yes.
Yes. And so I bring this up because I think one of the things that many people don't realize about Hyundai is that you guys have some leadership in hydrogen-powered vehicles.
We started selling leasing our hydrogen fuel cell vehicle in June of last year. So now we have a year and a few months of experience with this car. Our customers love the thing. So, when you think about hydrogen, it has all the characteristics of a gasoline car. It has the power delivery characteristics. Probably the most important thing about hydrogen is you can scale the powertrain to any vehicle type. It could be in a large SUV, it could be in a pickup truck, it could be in a bus, it could be an over-the-road vehicle. And in terms of powertrain packaging and fuel storage packaging, it's the same as gasoline. So you can basically move that powertrain to any vehicle type. So, unlike other energy storage methods, in particular, you look at electric vehicles, they're generally limited to smaller class vehicles because of the storage of energy issue. With these vehicles, hydrogen truly could displace gasoline vehicles in almost or virtually any vehicle category that we're selling today. And that's the real beauty of hydrogen. But beyond that, the refill time is the same as gasoline, about 3 minutes. And the range is about the same as gasoline. So we sell a fuel cell vehicle that's based on the Hyundai Tucson. And the range,
the last generation Tucson.
Yes, the last generation. And the acceleration and driving range and all those things that customers know and love about their gasoline Tucsons, but basically the same. The only thing you don't have is the sound of a gasoline engine. You have basically the sound of an electric motor instead.
So do you see this as the probable future for vehicles going forward?
Nobody knows. And I think at the end of the day, there's going to be a role for a number of different fuel types. Certainly electricity from a battery electric vehicle perspective will have a role in the market. There's no question about it. Hydrogen should have a role. And I think as a transition power source, plug-in electric vehicles have tremendous potential because customers can see the same kind of driving range they get with the best of gasoline, and they don't have to worry about the charging time and so forth. So we just launched our plug-in electric Sonata, and it has a 603-mile range. I think the EPA rating is about 27 miles pure electric. Mm-hmm. Our actual experience is actually doing much better than that. So, when you think about a normal driving pattern, normal commute back and forth to work, I could normally drive most of the time all electric. And then when I want to take a vacation or go on a long trip, I have a 600-plus mile range with it. So that's a vehicle for in the near term until all the challenges with infrastructure solved, whether it would be with battery electric vehicles or with hydrogen, you know, until the infrastructure does a better job of catching up to the vehicle technology, plug-in hybrids are a really good choice for many buyers.
So, Richard, you had some experience this week with the Tucson fuel cell vehicle, didn't you?
I've had two experiences, actually. I got a chance to drive it in February at the Chicago Auto Show, and let me tell you, it was like 29 degrees out there. So you get in it, and first of all, it's like a regular car. That's the nicest thing about it. The heater works like it normally would work. It doesn't make any strange noises. There's no compressor noises or any of that other stuff. It just, it's unnoticeable, really. Mm-hmm. But the acceleration is a lot smoother and quieter than you'd get out of a gasoline vehicle. I think it's a tremendous technical accomplishment that Hyundai's done there. Mm-hmm. Considering when you think the competition is Honda and Toyota and some of these others, you know, Hyundai is kind of a young company compared to those guys, but they've really stepped up and delivered a really nicely refined vehicle. But like all hydrogen vehicles, you know, until the fueling infrastructure gets in place, it's going to have a very limited appeal.
Right. And you mentioned the temperature because one of the concerns that some have with fuel cell vehicles is the water that's generated, whether it would freeze and not allow
So every car company has engineering standards they meet, and they, you know, because some companies, when you think about environmental issues, they call them suitability standards. And so the fuel cell vehicle that we're now selling meets the same suitability standards that our other vehicles, meaning that we have tested it in the International Falls area, we've tested it in the Arizona desert at our proving grounds. So it does meet the same environmental standards in terms of being able to run in ultra-cold temperatures as being able to equally well be operated in high heat temperatures. So, and we've had no restriction in the sales other than where the stations are at. So our sales have been restricted to those customers that say, through answering a survey on our webpage, if they have ready access to the fuel. That's been the limiting factor is just the stations. And as we know, the governor of California has earmarked $200 million for a hydrogen vehicle station expansion. By the end of this calendar year, there'll be about 20 stations in California. And then next year, they'll more than double. So it's just now, the money is just now starting to kick in terms of opening. The stations are opening now and becoming operational. They're working with a credit card just the way you would operate with you purchasing gasoline.
You know, Mike, I mean, with volume comes in infrastructure. So we've got gasoline, obviously, had an infrastructure because of the affordability of the gas car. You go up another $2,500 grand, you can get a diesel. So there's pretty good diesel infrastructure, both because of cars and trucks. Electrics are having a much tougher time with infrastructure because the only ones out there are $80,000. You don't have volume because you have just $80,000 Teslas running around. I mean, where is fuel cell in terms of the cost? Do you know right now? Is there? Can you put a number on it? Is it $10,000 more per car, $20,000?
I think the key thing to take away is that whether it's us or our competitors, all of us have said that there's a concrete, well-known pathway to cost reduction. So we know that we only need a single molecular layer of the rare metals for the catalyzed activity in the fuel cell stack. And so that's a manufacturing challenge to reduce the rare metals. And every manufacturer has shown plans to reduce the rare metal usage. And that's been a big step in reducing the cost of the vehicle. The next step, of course, is reducing the cost of the tanks. And there's been a lot of things taken in terms of automation to automate the tank winding and to create a much lower cost tank. So I think unlike some of the other technologies, I think the advantage of fuel cell is that when you think about R&D in terms of three basic phases, first, finding the invention, the technology, and finding its applicability to the personal vehicle space. And then second, finding a way to manufacture it. And then third, how do you scale it up and reduce cost? And that's where basically all the fuel cell manufacturers are coming to right now. They're in the third phase where it's now the cost reduction phase. Mm-hmm. They know how to make it durable. They know how to make large quantities of them. And when we figure out how to scale up the volume, with that's going to come a much lower cost basis.
So as a technology, fuel cell is much younger than battery technology or obviously diesel technology.
Yeah, of course, there's a lot of different ways to count, but we've been working at fuel cell technology for 15 years, and we all know that our company's had its ups and downs. And one thing that you could see just looking at the record, that even though we've been had some down periods, we've consistently invested in hydrogen. And I think it's our executives' strong belief that when you think about the true goal of zero emission vehicles is to displace gasoline vehicles. You need to think about a lineup of fuel cell vehicles that could actually displace gasoline vehicles. And right now, when you think about all the energy sources available, hydrogen's the one that comes out a clear winner in terms of being able to cover your entire lineup, from big SUV to full-size pickup all the way down to small car. And I think that's the thing that catches the attention of our management and the management of other big companies as well as government, is that the advantage of hydrogen in terms of covering the entire light vehicle fleet without any compromise, refueling time and the range and the power performance and the basic packaging of the powertrain are so close to what we already find appealing today, it minimizes the transition that customers have to make. Mm-hmm. And really, the infrastructure is the big question right now.
So there's no National Gasoline Day that I'm aware of. So anyway, so you brought to the studio the brand new Tucson.
I did.
Not the fuel. This is the new one.
This is.
And you guys are pretty excited about this car. I've had the opportunity to drive it. I don't know if you guys driven this car.
Not yet.
No. It's a great car. I've had the base.
So tell us why you think this is going to hit that sweet spot in the compact crossover market.
I am personally very, people tell me I'm a little bit quiet. I don't get excited about too much, but this vehicle is really an exciting vehicle for us for a number of reasons. One is when you think about what's changing in our society. When you think about urbanization and millennials, and you just look at construction projects today, and you think about now the old days, we grew up in houses with a nice lawn around it and a big yard. Nowadays, it's common wall construction, very compact shared garage spaces. People don't have the luxury of parking large vehicles as they did in the past. And, of course, fuel economy is a big interest for all of us in terms of greenhouse gas reduction, of also energy security in the long run. So when you think about a vehicle like this, it offers so much premiumness, I'll say. This is a global vehicle for Hyundai, and it's sold very widely in Europe as well as in Asia Pacific and the United States. And for that reason, this is one of those vehicles where a global nature of this development project has been a big advantage for us, because in Europe, this is a much higher class vehicle. And so noise damping, NVH, ride and handling, good basic interior quality levels, even in our most basic vehicle, are all much more important. And so we ended up here with a project that ended with a vehicle that feels very upscale. So as people drive, the comments we get back are, it feels like a class-up vehicle. It feels like a near-luxury vehicle. It's a very smooth driving vehicle. Fuel economy is excellent. This is one of the first DCTs that's in a utility product. So I think the other one's a Tiguan. Of course, I think the volumes of the Tiguan are relatively small.
So
not the
dual,
Tiguan, I'm sorry.
Dual-clutch transmission for those.
Yeah, it's a Touareg. I'm sorry, not the Tiguan, but the Touareg, I think, has a dual-clutch. So this was a lot of extra effort for our engineers to get the 7-speed DCT to work really well in an all-wheel drive with torque vectoring. And torque vectoring really allows much better handling, real confident handling.
So explain that, the torque vectoring.
What torque vectoring does is it eliminates that unsettling feeling, whether I drive it or whether one of my kids drive the car. When you have that initial turn in and the car, whether it's understeer and you get front tire scrub or an oversteer feeling, you get some slippage in the rear. What happens is through the electronics, we can, one, move a lot of the engine torque to the rear axle. That's the first step in torque vectoring. Then the second step in torque vectoring is to apply the inboard wheel on the rear. And that way, it gives you a nice, solid, planted feeling. So the input, the driver's input in the steering wheel, is what you feel in terms of the turning motion of the vehicle. So it basically builds confidence, and it improves the handling of the car.
So it's completely transparent to the person who's driving the car, but it doesn't feel like the car is skidding away.
It takes away the adverse yaw that people see as slipping or just a lessening control of the vehicle. Okay. It gives confidence of having more control of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And it certainly helps in inclement weather, no doubt about that.
In your all's torque vectoring technology, do you have a central case in the car? Is it the computers just controlling the two ends of the all-wheel drive?
So we use a Magna high-speed centered, some people would call it a center differential. What it really is a center coupling. It's a similar coupling that some of the German manufacturers use, very similar. So the advantage of the Magna Steyr coupling is that it's very high speed, and it has a very wide range of actuation. So it's very well suited for high speed use. And so the suspension and chassis control systems, the computer control systems, can do a very good job of measuring adverse yaw and then converting that into a signal to operate the torque vectoring system.
Some front-wheel drive cars are experimenting with torque vectoring now, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of the Tucson, this would just be on the all-wheel drive?
This is only on the all-wheel drive model, that's correct. Mm-hmm.
So tell us about what models this is available in, or trim levels that this car
is. Yeah, so we have an SE model, which is a base model you mentioned a little while ago, which, you know, is very nicely equipped. It feels very upscale, frankly. Then we have an eco model that focuses on fuel economy. So with that one, we get a 33 highway, a 29 combined fuel economy rating, which is very close to the very top of this area of the market. And then we have a turbo sport model as well. So for someone that wants 19-inch wheels and more sporty attributes, then we have that model. So basically three models, both in a two- and a four-wheel drive version.
So you can get four-wheel drive in the base model as well? Or
mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So
the base model has a 2-liter four-cylinder engine with a conventional, a normal torque converter-based six-speed automatic transmission. Then when you step up to the eco model, that you get the 1.6-liter turbo engine with the DCT seven-speed dual-clutch transmission. And then our sport model shares that powertrain as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you have two drivetrains, which is cool in this segment. I mean, some of your competitors, the RAV4, I think, is one of the top in the market. They only come with one, engine option. So I think that's like Ford, they have a couple engine options. I think that's one of the cool things about this car. You can do that step up in terms of power.
When you look at the customers for this car, I think we're going to find it's going to have a really wide appeal. So we have basically three primary CUVs in our lineup. We have, of course, the Tucson that appeals to generally younger families and couples. Then we have the Santa Fe Sport, which is basically an empty nester kind of a product. And then we have a long wheelbase Santa Fe that's a three-row model that's our core family model. And each one of these models, you have about an 8.5-inch step in terms of overall length. So there's a very clear differentiation between the products when our customers shop them in our showroom. Mm-hmm. So we go from this vehicle, and then we step up to the Santa Fe Sport. It's 8.5 inches longer, and then you step up to the long wheelbase three-row Santa Fe, and that's another 8.5 inches mm-hmm. longer. And you basically grow in terms of interior roominess as well as cargo space at about the same proportions.
So you mentioned this was pretty much a global product development. So what were some of the inputs that came from the U.S. market? What were some of the things that you thought were essential that this vehicle have?
You know, different than some other manufacturers, it's interesting. We all, read press materials and we read the stories that come out in various magazines and so forth. And, everybody talks about the next one always being a little bit bigger. You always see, the next this is it's 2 inches longer, 3 inches longer. With this one, it is a little bigger. There's no doubt about it. It's about 3 inches longer. However, the focus was not on making it bigger. It was making it the right size for these buyers. So there was a very strong focus by our product planning organization, our design group in Irvine, as well as our R&D function here in Detroit, as well as Korea, on finding what was the right size for these buyers. And really, we came to the conclusion that it would be easy to be the biggest in the segment. And we're not. We're not the biggest. But it would be better to be right for people that prioritize maneuverability and parking, particularly in these more urban environments where you don't have the big garage space or the big parking space that people have enjoyed in the past, and that the value of maneuverability and parking was really one of the key things that we've learned in the development of this. So finding the discipline to right size the car as opposed to doing the easy thing, just make it bigger, mm-hmm. was probably one of the toughest things, is finding that right size space for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think finding this place in terms of inflow, when you think about inflow, what are customers trading in when they buy these cars? Typically, for this kind of a CUV product, customers are more frequently trading in cars. Larger CUVs are more typically trading in another CUV. Hmm. So remember, this is an area of the market where customers are going to be more sensitive to good NVH and good driving dynamics and a nice interior fitment in terms of quality of materials, because they came from a car that had all those things. And it wasn't that long ago where CUVs were a little bit more truck-like, and they just didn't have those qualities. They were a little bit rougher riding. The NVH level was a little bit higher, and it was accepted. But when you think about the inflow, of these folks that are coming primarily from cars, they're replacing cars, I think our judgment was they're going to have a higher expectation. So we really embraced the idea of really leveling up NVH and interior fitment and driving dynamics as making that a key engineering goal for this product.
Mike, does that change? I mean, one of those sedans you're talking about is going to be a Sonata, which has been very popular in that segment. Now, this is the hot segment, the compact CUV. So as Hyundai buyers move from Sonatas and start looking at Tucsons, what's that do to a Sonata? Does the Sonata become a sportier car as a result?
That is a great, great question. And, you know, right now we're in the midst of working on our next Sonata, and that's one of the key questions we're asking ourselves is, what do we need to do with Sonata to make sure it maintains its competitiveness as a sedan? Because it's easy to make it bigger, but that's really not the point, right? So it's a question we haven't really come to an answer with yet. But one thing we all know in this room is that mid-car is declining slightly, and those buyers are going to CUVs like this one.
Yeah.
So we're going to see even more change, but we'll be coming back to ask you some questions about the Tucson and other things after we hear a word from our friends at Bridgestone and Firestone.
Firestone Destination LE2. Tough enough to handle anything the road throws at you.
Oops.
And you throw at it. Durable, dependable Firestone tires. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
And we're back. So we have some questions here for you, Mike. Not surprising. Steve B. wants to know, other than the vehicles shown at SEMA, so you guys have announced and teased a bunch of cars that you'll be showing in Las Vegas at the SEMA show. Hyundai seems to be going away from performance models. Do they no longer fit into Hyundai's image, or is there something on the horizon?
There is definitely something on the horizon. So please, I would never want anybody to leave with the impression that we're abandoning the performance area of the market. So we are very active in this area. It's a little bit quiet right now because we're in the middle of development of a number of projects. Remember, we have Veloster, which has a lot of potential to move in that direction. Of course, we have our Genesis Coupe that's done a great job for us. So a little early to talk about it, but I will say there's a lot of activity going on there, so not to worry.
Okay. So mentioning the Genesis Coupe, which sort of segues to Wright Knight wants to know, should Hyundai do a luxury brand positioned higher than Hyundai called Genesis for the larger rear-wheel drive models?
Another great question. So, you know, we're always studying what's the right approach to our market. And, of course, our Genesis sedan has done extremely well. You know, we're basically, I think, number three in the mid-luxury segment right now in terms of sales level.
Wow.
So we're definitely there in terms of sales. I think, you know, everybody would agree that, the basic market registration of the product has been very strong in terms of luxury and refinement and design. So we're, of course, looking at what's going to be our next step. You know, we're not too far away from having a new Equus in our lineup. We're reaching the end of that product's life. And so there's a lot of discussion on what we'll do in the future. Nothing's been decided yet, but we're close to, you know, doing something. And it's just really a matter of what's the right balance of using our presence in the premium side of the market as a way to build our brand qualities in the core area of the market. So on one hand, it's good for us to have these products as Hyundai products. On the other hand, we have to understand what luxury buyers are looking for and then think about what's going to be right for that from the customer's perspective. Mm-hmm. So those are all being discussed.
So you sort of answered this question, but Armand wants to know, says the Equus has not sold very well here in the U.S. Will it continue to be sold here in the years to come?
Short answer is yes, absolutely.
So, you know, it's sort of interesting to me, and you guys probably have noticed this as well, that, like, if we go to the original Genesis sedan that you guys came out with, I mean, it was you know, checked all the boxes, fully functioned. Mm-hmm. But the design was not all of that, stylish. I mean, it was very conservative styling. And, you know, we were talking earlier about sportiness, and I mean, you guys really amped that up for that vehicle. I mean, it just looks so much...
It's like an Audi.
Looks. Well, I mean, I think it looks faster. I mean, I think the way that the sheet metal's creased, that it's really changed a lot. And it almost says to me that, you know, that one of the messages that you guys are saying is that, yeah, you can have style and performance in a luxury sedan.
You know, I think a lot of credit goes to our designers that have really found a way to deal with the issues of package, manufacturability, and find ways to have a truly outstanding design. I think the Genesis is just a great example of one where our designers and our engineers really work well together. And I think our designers now have reached a cadence where they have a good sense of confidence on how to exhibit those qualities of great design and still make products that are competitively priced, and manufacturability and so forth are all adhered to. Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. I mean, I think that was the big, I mean, beyond the incredible value in that car, it was a recognition, particularly in this market, that design matters. And the Equus, which was the first in for a luxury Hyundai, was basically an executive's car from Japan, right? I mean, from Korea.
Yeah.
And so with the Genesis, second-gen Genesis, my sense was that Hyundai was really trying to get its arms around this market and compete against BMW and Audi here. Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the Tucson, you see another example of that. So the Tucson, the lead design group was in Europe for the exterior. The lead design group for the interior was right here in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And those groups work very well together, along with the engineers in both Ann Arbor and Korea.
And just clarification, when you were talking earlier about in Europe, this is at a higher level. In Europe, they're getting the same car that we can get here in Detroit.
It's basically the same car, different powertrains.
So it's just basically a perceptual thing. So the Europeans are saying, wow, this is really, you know, top of the line sort of thing. And here, this is a car that is accessible to lots of people.
Yeah. Yeah, we're very fortunate. I think it's on the short list for the North American Truck of the Year here. And I think it's also on the short list for the their truck of the year in Europe as well. So
yeah, we need a new category. It's not a truck.
What's fueling the boom in SUVs? Is it more than just low fuel prices, do you think?
I think low fuel prices is a coincidence, honestly. And there aren't that many coincidences that we've faced in this world. It usually is a reason. But I think that, you know, there's a lot of things going on. One is people want vehicles to do more. The other is there's fewer vehicles in the family fleet compared to years ago where we used to have purpose vehicles. Mm-hmm. Remember, you know, it was a time when we had the church van and, you know, we had dedicated used vehicles in our fleet. And now I think customers are looking for something that does everything well. They want good fuel economy. They want a nice quiet ride and, you know, good handling to their eye and their hands. And they want something that has good value. And I think what CUVs do today that they didn't do not that many years ago is they could offer everything. And customers don't feel like they're compromising. So I think more than the fuel price, I think the versatility and the ease of transition into one of these vehicle types now is just making them much more appealing. And when you think about it from a customer level, you walk into a Hyundai store, and this has roughly the same prices as a Sonata. You walk into a Toyota store, a RAV4 and a Camry, roughly the same price. And so they're looking at midsize sedans that they've known and loved well. They've had good use with them and good experience. And they see the CUV for roughly the same price that a few years ago it didn't have the same refinement, didn't have the same interior quality, but now they do. Mm-hmm. And so the sense of compromise is basically being erased.
And people like to get more stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Should we look at CUVs as sort of the modern station wagon and not the Land Rover type off-road vehicle?
You know, I don't know that so much anymore people are looking at CUVs as that off-road image vehicle. I just think people see them, generally speaking, as a much more versatile vehicle that does everything pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Switching gears a little bit here, so I have what you can see on the screen as a football. It's a very tiny football, blue football. I don't think footballs are blue. Be that as it may. So Hyundai now is the official sponsor of the NFL.
Yes, we are.
So clearly you guys are looking to reach a broader segment of the car buying public.
You know, I think we've reached a level of maturity where we really want to send a signal out that we're here to stay, that we have a big footprint here. You know, we have over, when you think about Hyundai dealer employees, our two plants here, our R&D center, our design centers, and of course our other operations here, we have over 60,000 direct employees. Wow. In the United States. So we're certainly invested here. And I think the NFL is just one way to signal to the market that we want to grow it into to the point where we become part of the fabric of our U.S. Mm-hmm. culture. And I think that's just one of those steps. We've been very active in college football for a number of years. We've been very active in FIFA and other activities like that. So I think for us, this is an evolutionary step, mm-hmm. and it's just another way to show our commitment.
Mm-hmm. So I know you can't talk about future product, but are there some vehicle architectures that you guys don't have that you would like to have in the showroom?
Well, we showed at the Detroit Auto Show our Santa Cruz concept, and we're working very hard on that one even now. We've actually moved one of our planners for the midterm assignment to Korea to work on this project. There's no green light yet. We haven't gotten approval, but we have a lot of engineers and designers working on it. So we'd like to find a new solution for open bed utility. Of course, in the past, it was always about payload and towing and bigness or size. And I think there's a space in the market for people that want something that they can put their dirty stuff in without messing up the same seats they put their kids in on the weekdays. They want something they can put oversized objects in. It doesn't have to weigh 2,000 or 3,000 pounds. It may just be oversized. And they just want something that's more versatile. And I think all the studies we've done shows there's a place in the market for that product. So that, for us, that's our...
Sorry, we got a question here. We have a quick answer. This is from A.M. Guerrero from Metro Manila in the Philippines.
Yeah.
The rear of the Tucson, the rear bumper looks well integrated with the back. How does the flush bumper design affect repair costs? I'm guessing it's not a 5-mile-an-hour bumper. In 10 seconds, answer that.
Honestly, I don't know if it's rated at 2.5 or 5. I'd have to check and get back with you on that one. So that's one I'll have to follow up on.
All right. So, Michael Bryan, Hyundai Motor America, thank you very much for coming.
And a little chemistry goes a long way, especially when it comes to vehicle development. From enabling the use of alternate materials to withstanding extreme vehicle environments, Henkel's adhesive, sealants, and surface technologies provide solutions for every vehicle segment. Come see for yourself. Our Detroit area headquarters offers 12 research and development and testing laboratories with the ability to do full-range testing and validation on actual vehicle parts. Sign up to tour our labs at henkelna.com/tour.
Okay, and we are back. So usually at a point in the show, I have to call for a number, and I have to have John get this number for me. But since I'm hosting the show today, I can call for the number myself without having John to be the intermediary. So, Ben, if you could pull this number up. So it was sort of interesting that in Paris, they've been having a problem with pollution. And earlier this spring, basically, the Eiffel Tower was being obscured by pollution. And this, as you can see, this is, that they became very upset.
And the mayor wants to ban diesels.
The mayor wants to ban more than diesels. Yeah. So there's this concern called AIRPAREF, which measures the level of pollution around the city. And they discovered that in one area that is by the Bastille, where the Bastille used to be, that basically this area was averaging 66 micrograms per square meter of nitrogen oxides, the bad stuff. And the limit that the European Union has is 40 micrograms per square meter. So on the 27th of September, 30% of Paris, just for a day, 30% of Paris, all cars were banned. So not just these, all cars were banned. And they actually, the mayor wanted more of Paris, but apparently for logistical reasons, they couldn't possibly do this. And so as a result of that, they discovered in the city center that the nitrogen oxide levels were down by 40%. Okay, so I started thinking about this, and I want to get your guys' take on this. Are we going to see more large municipalities making moves like this, restricting automobiles?
Well, let's just start from the beginning. It could be that the EPA that was right from the very start to regulate for NOx, whereas the Europeans were regulating for CO2. It's NOx that is the cause of soot and and these other emissions that are troubling the French right now. Mm-hmm. Plus, they've had diesels on the road there for a long time. There are a lot of older ones that put out a lot more pollution. So, no, I don't think there's going to be... I think we're going to see cleaner diesels, but I don't think that...
But it almost seems like... I mean, they're just looking at cars in general, though. I mean, it's just like cars are bad things. Now, Henry, I know that you don't think cars are bad things.
I love cars. Yeah, I mean, these are first world nitpicks, you know. I mean, if you want to have air quality issues, go to China, go to emerging economies.
Right.
I mean, you know, these are the luxuries that first world countries have, and ultimately it affects consumers and affects businesses. If municipalities ban cars, and of course, you know, Volkswagen, all of Lower Saxony and Germany is going to be in recession if they get hit by $18 billion in EPA fines. So, you know, there are larger issues here than you know, occasional air quality.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with Rich. I mean, I don't think this is a long-term trend. It's one of the least things we have to worry about in the first world.
So speaking of the first world and speaking of reducing emissions, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we all drove the new 2016 Chevy Volt. And, you know, when you look at the numbers for the sales numbers for the Volt so far this year, I mean, it's not so good. I mean,
82,000 total sold since launch.
And that's globally since launch. So this year in the United States, 9,264 Volts were sold. That's down 36.3% compared to the same period last year. And I was looking to see if Chevrolet had another car that sold less well, and that would be the SS, which is obviously a limited performance vehicle, and it had 2,421, but it was up 36.3%. So the Volt was down 36.1%, and here's the SS up 36.3%. So, I mean, that said, I was really impressed by the new Volt. I mean, I thought that the ride and handling was great, powertrain was seamless, the interior was not pretending to be an iPod from 3 or 4 years ago. I mean, I think they executed this car very well. But then I say,
why? But here's the thing. First of all, the numbers that you just recited don't tell the whole story. Nobody's buying hybrids when their gas is $2.50 a gallon. The reason to buy is not there. The old GM would have thrown in the towel, but this is a new era at GM, and they understand that, like Toyota did with the Prius, you've got to nurture technology along, and also you've got to have the technology there for when there's some saber-rattling going on in the Middle East and gas spikes to $4 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
Because development lead times are so long that if you get caught with your plants down and you can't produce this stuff, then you're in trouble. And so regardless of the number of sales, I think we're always going to see electrified vehicles in everyone's lineup now.
But yeah, it's not just the new GM. It's the new government. I mean, the GM gets huge credits for building this vehicle against the 54.5 by 2025 regs. So, you know, a lot of these companies are making product decisions based on government regulations, not just because of sales. I see this common thread between the SS and the Volt. I like you guys, I really like the Volt technology. The styling, it looks like a Chevy Cruze until you get up close.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I've always had this problem with the Volt. I think one of the reasons that the Prius was a success was because it looked like it was its own brand. It was its own look. And so the niche that wants to drive that car, just like muscle car guys want to drive something that looks like a Camaro and a Mustang, it looks different than anything else on the road. I think green buyers, and that's still the majority of this buyer, want something that defines the owner as green.
So when they're driving down the street, somebody automatically knows without to read a little badge on the back of the car.
And yeah, you get that unique metal fascia on this Volt. But from a distance, it's a Cruze. I would have much preferred something that looked more like the Opel Ampera or even the Cadillac ELR, something that really stands out and says, you know, this is a green car.
You know, I used to think that way until last week when I went to California. Did you notice how many Priuses were there? They're like fleas. They're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the reason is people don't care what it looks like. They want to get in that HOV lane.
Right.
Because out there, you really...
But I think they've run out of stickers. I think that you buy a Prius now and...
I mean, it's like... the Prius did a lot of things great, but it was never a car that you'd be passionate about driving. So I think there are other reasons why...
You wouldn't be passionate about driving it if you were a person who wants the exhilaration and excitement of a Chevy SS or a Mustang or a Camaro or something like that. I think that you can be passionate about it if your thing is, you know what, I'm getting 50 miles per gallon and I'm driving right by that gas station. I mean, and so there are people that do that. I mean, I think that it's too easy for us in Detroit sometimes to just think that everybody's just all about performance when you realize that there are a lot of people who are very frugal and thrifty and say, you know what, that's a good thing.
Well, to Henry's point, when in another career of mine, when I was working at another place, there was some talk about having two versions of the C-Max, right? A regular version.
This is the Ford C-Max.
Yes, the Ford C-Max. There was a regular version that was coming out, and then there was the hybrid version. And at the very last second, they killed the regular version because they wanted people to know that when they saw a C-Max, they were driving a hybrid. There was no other powertrain available in it. And I thought that strategy was pretty good for the times, but now hybrids are just about in everyone's lineup, and I don't know that thinking is still,
Well, and I bet the C-Max numbers are below the Volt numbers.
Yeah, they're...
I mean, it's a tough market.
It is a tough market.
Here's another piece of it. I drove around Sausalito on our drive, and as Rich says, there are Priuses everywhere. And I talked to a couple of Prius owners. I drove up, parked the Volt, the new Volt, next to their Prius, said, what do you think? And both of them, first thing out of their mouths was, I like it, it's too expensive.
Mm.
And there is, I don't think people in that price segment think right away about the government's incentives. The first thing they see is the sticker, and they see a Volt that is $10,000 more than their Prius.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that'll be a problem with the new one?
I have to give you full disclosure. Our family has had two Volts, and the deals that you can get on them are quite frankly pretty spectacular.
That would be for the 2015, but going to the 2016, which I think that they're more serious about. But I mean, so you wrote about it this week, and you were very very positive about your experience in driving it. Tell the audience.
You know, I felt like it was a car that you would enjoy driving.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you don't have to put gasoline in very often was maybe secondary to the fact that it's just a really nice car to drive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, you know, a kind of a small package for what you might consider a lot of money. But, I mean, look at a Focus ST or something like that. That's $30,000. I mean, you get a lot of technology in that car.
Yeah, it was interesting. They were saying, what was it, the median period between refuelings, they expect to be on the order of 1,400 miles?
Something between 1,000 and 1,500, depending on your usage cycle.
Yeah, because I thought they said that like now it was 12 or something like that, and because of the extended electric range, it's even greater. So just, can you imagine that? I mean, it's just like, wow. But that's predicated on people plugging in on a regular basis. It's not, you're not going to get 1,200 miles just by filling up your Volt and driving.
Here's the Achilles heel with that car. If you look at GM's marketing efforts, they haven't been very good for a lot of things for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
They have to figure out how to sell this car. I think the engineers did their job and made it great. Can they sell it? We'll have to see.
Well, and they do have an advertising campaign, and they're going hard after Leaf and Prius. Yeah. So that will be different this time. Yeah.
And those ads are pretty funny.
Yeah.
I mean, if they come out. And,
you know,
and
there's, ad, yeah.
It's very likely that they'll come out and there'll be those ads, but... I don't know that doesn't, you know, like comparing to the Leaf and especially the Prius. I mean, because there's a new Prius coming out that's going to change up everything. So we're quickly going to be taking a break and hearing from our friends at Dodge. We'll be right back.
We don't have to worry about predators like our ancestors did. No saber-toothed tigers stalking from the brush. No dire wolves circling the camp. There are no more monsters to fear. And so, we have to build our own.
And we're back. So we have a phoned-in question. So, Ben, could you please bring that in?
Hi, love your show. I have three cars. One of them is a Mercedes SLK. One of them is a hybrid Honda. My husband just got a Dodge Durango. That Durango has more bells and whistles than my Mercedes does. And I give them kudos for everything. And I just wanted to make him aware. Thank you.
So a nice shout out there for Klaus Busse who's in charge of interior design at Chrysler or FCA America, excuse me.
Yeah.
We've had him on the show.
Have you seen the taillights of the Durango at night? Really distinctive looking. So
yeah,
pretty good stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But that's also the new generation of car. I mean, I think that's one thing that's driving sales to 17 million this year is that people are coming in showrooms and they're finding stuff in mainstream cars that used to be that you could only find in luxury cars two generations ago. I mean, it's remarkable. The Volt we drove, I just drove the new Honda Civic.
You can't talk about that.
I can't talk about my impressions, but I can tell you about what's in it. Talk about what's in it.
No, you can't.
Well, yeah, thanks, Coach.
Well, I'm just
so that the Volt has the Volt and the Cruise coming here shortly after it. Have Apple CarPlay, Android Auto. They have things in the console that you still can't find in a lot of luxury cars. I mean, it's fabulous.
So that's a perfect segue to something that I want to talk about. I don't know if you guys saw that there was a piece Johnny Lieberman did in Motor Trend about the 911 Carrera and Carrera S. And so in it, he writes that it doesn't have Android Auto. Okay, and this is quoting his story, as part of the agreement, so it says, why doesn't it have it? As part of an agreement, an automaker would have to enter with Google, which provides Android Auto. Porsche said certain pieces of data must be collected and transmitted back to Mountain View, California, home of Google. Mm-hmm. Stuff like vehicle speed, throttle position, coolant and oil temperature, engine revs. Basically, Google wants a complete OBD2 dump whenever someone activates Android Auto. Okay. Now, Google found out about this story, and they had a response. And so Google's response is, steering the story straight, we take privacy very seriously and do not collect the data that the Motor Trend article claims, such as throttle position, oil temp, and coolant temp. Users opt in to share information with Android Auto that improves their experience, so the system can be hands-free when in drive and provide more accurate navigation through the car's GPS. So I put to you guys, we all like to have things like Android Auto, or we like to use Waze on our phone to find out where there's traffic jams and what might be slow. But whenever we do these things, we're agreeing that they can have our information. Is this an Achilles heel for this stuff?
Not for me. I mean, I kind of assume everything's public these days anyway. But I mean, the benefits of that technology are good. If there's a privacy issue, there'll be a backlash there, but that's obviously something to look at.
What do you think, Richard?
You know, there's a vocal contingent of people who don't want the government or anybody else knowing where they're going and how fast they're getting there. I can relate to that, but, you know, if you have tens of millions of users feeding this data, what are the chances of anyone other than just, you know, correlating yours with everyone else's? I don't think it's a big deal, really. I don't.
So what if they know that Henry drives exceedingly fast all the time and they just want to keep an eye on him?
Well, you know, now if Google was to sell that information to Henry's insurance company, Henry could be a little ticked, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Depends. It depends what this information is going to be used for. But
so in other words, you guys don't think this is an issue?
Not yet.
Okay.
We don't know what the motives are.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Once that's a little clearer, maybe.
Mm-hmm. But that's precisely the thing that'll worry consumers if Google starts selling stuff to insurance companies. That's precisely the thing that I think consumers will react against.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Google, like any product maker, It needs to know its customers.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Here's another question from Wright Knight. We heard from him earlier, but this is an interesting question. Will the three-box sedan grow in tallness so as to compete with the crossovers in the future? So are we going to have more like maybe Fiat 500Xs or something? I mean, that's the only thing that I can think of is an example of that. Maybe that's a bad example, but...
You know, here's an interesting thing. We're starting to see what used to be just regular hatchbacks being called CUVs now, right?
Mm-hmm.
This Mazda 3 or CX-3, that's a hatchback. It's no different than the Pontiac Vibe Toyota Matrix from a few years ago. It's not a CUV. It's a hatchback.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the marketing that will change, right? Mm-hmm. More than the shape, I think.
Well, O'Brien was interesting in saying that, in working on the new Sonata, they're very aware that their customers are going to Tucson's. So how does that change the sedan dynamic? And what we can say about the new Civic, which is already out there, is that they've lowered the CG on that car. They've lowered the seat by an inch and a half.
So it appears to be lowered.
No, they told us that in the rollout. Oh. And so that's a reaction to their customers going to CRVs.
So I think
they're making the Civic sportier.
So I think maybe, you know, to what Mike was saying, that, you know, that this awareness, so maybe what you don't necessarily do is try to copy that architecture as much as you reconsider what you're putting out on the street as a sedan.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So Michael Horn was speaking in front of Congress. He's the president of Volkswagen of America. So we can't go without a question about Volkswagen. So Andrew wants to know, is VW of America just being extra cautious about the auxiliary emissions control device software in its new EA288 diesel? What happens to VW's reputation in European business if the EPA finds this device is also a violation? Do you guys know anything about that?
No, but here's what I can tell you from just talking to people. And
you know a lot about powertrain.
Volkswagen knows exactly what's wrong and exactly how to fix it and exactly how much it's going to cost. And it takes a long time to get all those ducks in a row before they can come out and say, give specific time frames, because there's deals that have to be made with suppliers, there's software that has to be written and delivered, and they've got to like run through a maze, right? They can't degrade fuel economy and performance so much that it triggers even more consumer class action lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough nut, but not an impossible one for Volkswagen to solve. You're going to see some hardware changes, you're going to see some software changes, and you might see some checks being written to Volkswagen customers.
Yeah. Yep. And they seem to indicate that this is you know, mid-2016 for the software change.
Well, we got roughly 500,000 cars in the U.S. and 10.5 million globally, so it's
right.
A pretty big problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, but that'll be interesting to see what the fix is, right? We have Mazda that basically has the same brand image in this market as VW, as a sporty performance sedan, and they still haven't figured out how to make a diesel work in that mm-hmm. segment. So is the result of these fixes going to be a less sporty VW?
That
hurts their brand. I mean, that's what they're about, is performance and engineering.
I don't think VW needs to worry inordinately about selling too many diesels in the future. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that. I think that, and then when it comes to their dealerships, I mean, I'm sure that the people in the dealerships will say, look, we've got this really nice, you know, Type R Golf, and it's got this really high-performance gasoline-powered engine, and you really want that car, and that's the car for Henry.
Yeah.
Well, they won't be selling any diesels for 2016 because they withdrew their
right.
certification request for that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to take a while for Volkswagen to get back up on four wheels again,
right.
That's for sure.
Okay, we have another question. This goes back to the Volt. Robert wants to know, would making the federal discount applicable at time of sale help Volt sales? FYI, it took me 2 years to get my refund from the government. They even paid me interest because it was their error that held up the payment.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you go to the dealership and, you know, they hand you a check?
No, it isn't that at all. It comes off your income tax.
The tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
Credit. So it's not like you're going to get a $7,500 check from the government.
Mm-hmm.
No. But if it, you know, we leased two of them, and I believe that was factored in
right.
at that time.
So you basically got the money
yeah.
immediately.
Right.
As it were.
Right.
Okay, one final thing, because I see we're at the top of the hour. So ABC News had a report this week. and it opened. U.S. counterterror officials have asked Toyota, the world's second largest automaker, after Volkswagen, to help them determine how ISIS has managed to acquire the large number of Toyota pickup trucks and SUVs seen prominently in the terror group's propaganda videos in Iraq, Syria, Libya. What do you guys make of that?
The government's asking the wrong entity. Remember a few months ago when the plumbing truck from Texas ended up in the Middle East and they left the placard on the side of it and the company was getting hate mail? Well, it was traced back to the fact that the truck was traded in at an AutoNation store in Texas and somehow ended up in the Middle East. Well, it's not like ISIS is going to Toyota and doing fleet deals. It's they're coming, you know, through the used market, obviously.
So, right.
So...
Yeah, but at least Toyota can come out publicly and say we condemn their use of our vehicles. I mean, I reviewed the Fiat 500L this week, which the Pope drove 2 weeks ago to global publicity, and Fiat won't touch it. Fiat won't comment because they, you know, the area of religion is just so sensitive.
Right.
They don't want to use that as a promotional. Mm-hmm. So at least Toyota can say about this.
You know, and it's sort of, I mean, one of the things, I mean, and this is
politics is tricky.
Is that they really can't say, well, you know, they're looking for quality, durability, reliability, just like we are. But so it's interesting. I did a little research on this, and I found that in November of 2010, Car and Driver wrote an article about vehicles like the Toyota Hilux, which is one of the vehicles that is being investigated by the counterterrorism group, saying, you know, like, yeah, that's a pretty popular vehicle, and the Toyota Land Cruiser, which is also in there. But, you know, Range Rover Defenders are being used. I mean, so these are all vehicles. I mean, so why is it surprising to anybody that they're rolling around a lot of these vehicles? The Nissan Patrol is another car that seems to be very popular, truck that's very popular.
Well, some of these things are coming, you know, starting, are ending up over there from the U.S. That's
right.
Probably what the concern is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of Ford F-150s over there and probably some Chevys, too. So I think the government's right to be concerned how they're getting there. But, you know, once they're on the used market, the automaker has very little control over where they go.
Mm-hmm. Then I discovered something else that people can win bar bets with, that there was actually something called, the nickname, of course, the Toyota War. The last phase of the Chadian-Libyan conflict in 1987. And so what it turned out, it takes its name from the Toyota pickup trucks used as technicals to provide mobility for Chadian troops as they fought against the Libyans. And so basically, I mean, if you Google Toyota War, you come up with this. So again, I mean, this is, I just found that reporting a little bit over the top, like, gee, what a surprise. Why, you know, sure, F-150, perfect, right?
Yep.
Big, capable.
There might be some local production of those Toyota trucks over there, too, that makes them easier to get.
Yeah.
Who knows?
So anything else you guys think we ought to talk about?
Well, I think we've covered it pretty good there, Gary.
I just think that the VW thing is going to be with us for a while. You know, I was talking to a couple of researchers today who are working on reducing diesel emissions, and they're taking some innovative approaches to it. The diesel engine's got a black eye right now, but it'll survive.
Well, and I do think that, I mean, VW obviously deserves the bad publicity because they cheated. Yeah. But I do think that the government and companies need to work together on this. I mean, this is a good technology. TDI technology is a good technology. It's used elsewhere in the world to good effect. And I hope that the EPA, as it judges where to go from here, doesn't use this as an opportunity to kill diesel. I think diesel is a wonderful option in this country for a lot of people.
What this really did is it pointed up how poorly administered the testing procedures are. The EPA has, you know, now said they're going to test these things on the road. Well, guess what? They should have been doing that in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Not because they suspected anybody of cheating, but because they should have been doing it just to be doubly sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a whole other can of worms, which we certainly don't have time to get into here. But, you know, one of the interesting things is that, okay, this defeat device was software. Okay, it wasn't a hardware. It wasn't a piece of metal. It was all software. And John has mentioned several times on the show about this whole effort that some automakers are having in terms of digital rights management, whereby they're saying, this is our software. you don't mess with our software, you can't get into our software, you can't see our software. Yeah. And had those Virginia Tech guys not been able to get into that software, they may not have been able to find that thing. So this is a sort of a blow on behalf of why these things ought to be kept open and not kept proprietary.
Yeah. This is another reason why I like my old car so much, because they got no computing power.
Yeah, Google, and that becomes...
Google doesn't know what I'm doing.
Yeah,
in that,
exactly.
In my old Triumph, they're never going to know.
Okay, so with that, now that we know Google doesn't know what Richard's up to, so Richard Truitt, Automotive News, people can find your stuff there, and your piece on the Vault this week is, I think, worth reading. Henry Payne, the Detroit News, always good to see you. And
thanks, Gary.
You always have these provocative ideas, and look for you at debtnews.com, right?
Debtnews.com, henrypayne.com, yeah. I'll be reviewing the Vault in a couple weeks.
So. Okay. And
must to read.
So next week, John will not be here again, so we're going to have a roundtable. This should be fairly exciting. We're going to have... Sharon Carty of Yahoo Autos. We're going to have the irascible Scott Burgess of Motor Trend and Mike Whalen of Detroit News, right? Mike,
colleague, yes.
Colleague
covers
Detroit
Fiat
News.
Chrysler.
Fiat Chrysler, that didn't go on strike last night, so apparently he's been covering this very carefully. So you can see me at autofieldguide.com. Friend Autoline at facebook.com/AutolineNetwork. Follow Autoline on Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline. And thank you, everybody, for joining us. And I hope you enjoyed the show as much as I did. See you next week.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Dodge. And by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.